Dave Green. I'm a maths teacher at a local secondary school, and I do some lay preaching in the Methodist Church. I am not somebody who has struggled with massive tragedy in my life. So what I'm offering this evening is as a result of stuff that people that I've met, who I know, and discussed with, and things that I've read in the Bible. And I hope that it will be useful, but I offer it in the knowledge that each of us has had their own experiences. And so if what you find is not helpful, feel free to either discard it or store it for another day, okay? And there's going to be a mixture this evening. Some of the responses that we're going to be looking at are going to be slightly philosophical. Some are going to be much more raw and pastoral. And I hope that there'll be something for everybody to sort of consider. And it's very much not the last word. These three that we've done are really starting points in these issues. And so I hope that in the next 60 minutes, they'll make you think, they'll provide you with comfort and encouragement. I don't think they'll be the definitive answer by any means, but hopefully they'll be part of our journey as Christians as we reflect on these very important issues. Because, as I said, I think in the notices, we're all going to face adversity sooner or later, no matter how successful you are and how youthful you are and how well life goes for you. One day you will face adversity, and that capacity to wrestle with adversity and to reflect on it from a Christian perspective can be enormously helpful, although still a journey for everybody. Let's start with a film clip. Let me introduce it. In 1940, C.S. Lewis, which I'm guessing most of you have heard of, the children's writer of the Narnia Chronicles, wrote a book called The Problem of Pain, and it was a theological, philosophical treatise, quite academic, a little bit on the dry side, as he wrestled with pain and suffering from a Christian perspective. Then in the 1950s, he met a woman called Joy Gresham, who's a poet, and they got married. And initially, this marriage was kind of a marriage of convenience. I wouldn't recommend this as an approach, but he wanted to give her the opportunity to live in the UK, so he married her so she could do that. But gradually, feelings for her became deeper. And it was about that time that he discovered that she'd got cancer. And we're going to just see a film clip from the film Shadowlands. Some of you might have seen this before. As this academic who's written all this philosophical stuff actually starts to encounter real life with a jolt.
Yesterday, a friend of mine, a very brave, good woman, collapsed in terrible pain. One minute she was fit and well, next minute she was in agony. She's now in hospital, and this morning I was told she's suffering from cancer. Why?
See, if you love someone, you don't want them to suffer. You can't bear it.
You want to take their suffering onto yourself. If even I feel like that, what isn't God?
Harish?
Not good.
I'm so sorry, Jack.
I just wanted to be well again, you see.
Of course you do. We all do.
What a dangerous world we live in, Molly.
Well, you've been up all night. Why don't you get some sleep?
No, I can't sleep. Ah, it's all too soon, you see. I just haven't had time at all.
Time for what?
I don't know. To talk. Say things.
It doesn't take long.
No, I suppose not.
Whatever it is, I should just say.
Yes, you must be right, Warnie. But it is difficult, you see.
Yes, I do see that.
Yes, Dr. Craig, this is my brother, Warnie.
How do you do? Your wife.
How is she? Any change?
We've made her as comfortable as we can. Otherwise, there's nothing further to report.
How much has she been told?
She's been told that the cancer has eaten away her left femur.
Oh, no.
She knows it's serious. The thigh bone snapped like a frozen twig.
I see.
Can anything be done?
She's dying, Warnie.
That's putting it more starkly than I would choose, Mr. Lewis.
No, but it's true, isn't it?
The cancer is very advanced.
C.S. Lewis wrote another book called The Grief Observed. And for many, it's regarded as an astonishing exploration of some of the struggles in that context when somebody close has died. He writes the following: "No one ever told me that grief felt so much like fear. I'm not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning. I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There is a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be about me. I dread the moments when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me." For many of us, the problem of pain and suffering are probably one of the most difficult things we'll face, either as individuals or perhaps from people who don't follow our faith, asking questions. And I thought we'd start by spending a bit of time just discussing in our groups, what are the big questions raised by suffering? And I wonder if you can just talk about amongst yourselves for about 5 minutes. What are the questions that come to mind when you see suffering in the world, when you encounter it yourself, when you hear about it with others? What are the main questions that come to mind? Please don't curtail your conversations, but what I'd like you to move towards is a writing down of any questions that you've got. And I'd like you to be as honest as you feel like. I mean, you don't have to sign the things, but one of the things we're going to talk about this evening is the extent to which Christians in the Bible ask God very honest, blunt questions. And if you look at the book of Job, if you look in the Psalms, one of the things that you find is that God is not troubled by our bluntness at that point. So I want to encourage you as part of that process. So maybe you'll do it emotionally, or maybe you'll do it academically or philosophically, to take a post-it and write a question or two on there, and we're going to stick them on the board. So if you could get one person from each of your tables after a few minutes has gone by to go and plaster them on the board. Nobody will know who's done what, hopefully. And I'll read some of those out, and we'll use those a little bit to inform what we're doing this evening. Let's have a look at some of these. I'm not going to answer them all now, but I am going to bounce off them a little bit, hopefully in the course of the evening, if that makes sense. Whose fault is it? Could the suffering be avoided? Where is God in the suffering? Is one person suffering greater than another? Is there a scale, or is it all relative? Why do good people suffer? What bad decisions have I made to get to this? Okay, the sense that suffering might be to do with us. I'm just going to take that one straight away. I think that there is a great part, there's one of the chapters in Luke where a disaster happens, and Jesus is asked to respond. The Tower of Siloam and the slaughtering of the Galileans. And he's asked to respond, and there's a sense in him. And he answers straight away about the question of what did these guys do to deserve it. And there is no sense in which he makes a connection between the appalling suffering that happened and what happened to these guys. And we'll talk a bit more about that later on. We live in a fallen world. Why does God answer some and not others? What have I done to deserve this? Why? Why does God allow it? Why does God not solve it? Why me? Why them? Why doesn't he answer my prayers? Why me? Why my loved ones? Why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people? Why cannot God take people to die quickly and without suffering if their time comes? Why allow mental problems? The one thing you need to reach God isn't working. Why does it happen to good people? And why does God seem silent? Okay. Let's reflect on that a little bit more. But I'm going to tell some stories as well this evening, because I think sometimes we respond to propositional truth, you know, just bullet point stuff. But sometimes we respond even more to listening to stories. And one of the comments that I made this morning was that the early church found a way of articulating the message of suffering in a way which was better than any other belief system at the time. It was one of the things that struck the pagans. Not only are these Christians astonishing when they suffer, but they die so well. And I just want to pass on a story of the early church which kind of illustrates this. This is AD 260. I don't know whether you know this, but in the Roman Empire there were two great plagues. And they killed tens and thousands of people. And Dionysius, I'm working on my pronunciation there, who was an eyewitness at the time, he said the following. He said, at the first onset of the disease, citizens pushed the sufferers away and fled from their dearest, throwing them into the road where they were dead and treated unburied corpses as dirt, hoping thereby to avert the spread and contagion of the fatal disease. But to do what they might, they found it difficult to escape. So imagine the desperation in a Roman city at the time, and one of your relatives contracts the plague, and you know that it's highly contagious. Yeah, what the citizen were doing is just chucking them into the street. Get them out of the house for the sake of everybody else. And what the Christians were doing was going round and picking them up and tending to them. Your immediate reaction would be in that situation, got to get me out, got to get my family out. But the Christians stayed in the city and they went around and they collected these suffering Romans. And the eyewitness report goes on to say, most of our brother Christians showed unbounded love and loyalty, never sparing themselves and thinking only of one another. Heedless of danger, they took charge of the sick, attending to their every need and ministering to them in Christ. And with them departed this life serenely happy, for they were infected by others with the disease, drawing on themselves the sickness of their neighbours and cheerfully accepting their pains. Many, in nursing and curing others, transferred their death to themselves and died in their stead. The early church was so convinced that they had a response to suffering that they were prepared to offer their lives in that situation. And some of those pagans who were left out in the streets to die were ministered to by the Christians. And the Christians died and the pagans survived. And the Christians were prepared to do that because of what they'd come to believe in the New Testament church. So let's have a look at some of those things. Christianity has a unique perspective on suffering, because it tackles suffering in a number of different ways. First of all, unlike your Buddhists, Christians believe suffering is very real. And I guess we all get that, don't we? That we don't think it's an illusion, that we can somehow distance ourselves from it, that we can get more and more displaced from that suffering. It's very, very real. Secondly, unlike believers in karma, Christians believe that suffering is often unjust and disproportionate. Some of the post-it notes picking up on the fact that it seems like sometimes bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. And so in this life, it's not quite as simple as you might believe if you've just read the book of Proverbs. If you just read the book of Proverbs, it seems like you do the right thing and good things happen. You do the wrong thing and bad things happen. But you've really got to read on to Job, haven't you? And Ecclesiastes, to get the full picture of what the Bible says about suffering. And the Bible says very clearly that it's really not as straightforward as that. Sometimes if we do bad things, there is a sense in which it catches up with us. And sometimes if we do good things, we prosper. But also sometimes suffering is unjust and it's disproportionate. And finally, unlike the Stoics, the people of the time in the New Testament church, the pagans, you can't just keep it at a distance and stand there and pretend it's something that you can just cope with heroically. Sometimes suffering feels like it's going to completely overwhelm you. And that's one of the things that comes through the Psalms. Spend any time in the Psalms. I mean, often the Psalms we read out at church are the really nice ones, aren't they? But actually, there's a lot of suffering and torment and lament that goes on in the Psalms, isn't there? As people reflect on the sufferings that they're going through and feel overwhelmed. Let's have another story. Louise, you're going to read us Emily's story.
Life Story, The Fairy Tale Ending by Emily. If you'd asked me what I was thankful for before September, I would have said I am thankful for my family, my home, my job, and for God. For a husband who loves and cares for me, for four children, ages 14, 11, 9, and 5, who are healthy and happy, for a home I never dreamed I could have, for a career that allows me to work from home, use my brain, and make a difference for my company and my clients, and for a God that has provided me those things, regardless of my worthiness. In September, completely out of the blue, my husband left me and our four children for someone else, who left her husband and two children as well. This other family were friends of ours. We'd vacationed with them on three separate occasions during the summer. I thought they were our friends. My heart died within me. This could not be happening. My Christian husband, the one who with me sat down with our kids and explained that while divorce does happen, it would never happen to us. We made a covenant, a promise to God and to each other. No matter what, we will always be here for each other and for them. I sobbed and begged him not to go, that we could figure this out. No, he was leaving. I asked what he was going to tell the kids. He said he didn't know. I told him, you can't just leave without telling the kids something. Surely this would hit him. He would not be able to look at these precious children and tell them that he was leaving. But he did. He called them back downstairs from bed and told them he was leaving. They didn't understand. Is this for work? Well, when would he be back? No, kids, I'm moving out, not to come back. He left. We were crushed. After 8 weeks, my heart was still crushed. God, is this really your plan? How could this be your plan? I know that you will heal my heart. I know that something good will come from this. But how and why this? I feel people praying, but what is going to become of us? I have never been so angry. Our poor children are suffering terribly. Their father's wants come before their needs. I still love my kids, he says. Really? How can you love them and cause them such pain? After 4 months, God is beginning to heal me in a way I'm not sure I want to be healed. I want to see justice, but it's not mine to inflict. I am beginning to try to pray for him, not about him. I am beginning to pray for his heart to be healed, for him to come back, not to me, but back to God. I need to move on without him, for now and maybe forever, but I have to forgive him to get through the bitterness. I will not be bitter for the rest of my life. But how am I going to make it? God says, pray, so I do. I love my family, and I will always love the man I married. I'm praying for a miracle, for him to snap out of this and find his way back home. But I'm also moving forward without him. I'm planning and trying to continue with my life, with everything that needs to be done from a practical, spiritual, emotional and financial perspective. I'm going to pray for him on a regular basis. I'm going to love him, but I will not be a doormat. I'm going to support my family, and I'm going to seek God's plan for our life. I am going to forgive him, but I won't forget. Because if I forget, I won't be able to use what I learn to help others who may go through this nightmare. I need to feel the pain. Allow God to heal that pain and transform me into something that he had intended for me to become all along. Somehow, I feel excited. It feels wrong in so many ways to be excited to be going through this nightmare. It has now been 6 months. My situation has gotten worse, and yet I feel truly blessed. My husband is still gone, still with his girlfriend. He has told me that they will be part of our kids' lives, and I need to get used to that and not hate her. He told me that if she was my enemy, then I was his. My kids are still dealing with the impact that their dad left. They are depressed, angry, confused, and frustrated. My oldest has started questioning his faith. He is rebelling against all authority and lashing out at his family. My house is up for sale, a short sale, which could turn into being a foreclosure. We have no idea where we will move. And yet, in the midst of all this, I have come to know God on a different level, to see him work in a way I had only heard about. To experience this is quite amazing. I've never had a big tragedy in my life, never really had to depend on God. I mean, sure, I prayed and I saw God work, but not like this. I never had the need to rely on God, truly just fall and rest on him. When I needed God's comfort, the image in my head was me clinging to Jesus and him hugging me. My image now is me just completely collapsed and him carrying me, and it is awesome. In the midst of this horrible situation, where my whole identity and where my family has been attacked, I see glimpses of what God is doing and how my life and our lives will be changed. And I get excited to see who I get to be at the end of all this. Like being in a race where it starts to rain and you hit a mud puddle. You can't go around it, you have to go through it. And the rain and the mud are weighing you down. You can't go through it fast. You must concentrate on each painful step. But at the same time, something is keeping you upright and compelling you to continue. In the distance, you see what appears to be a sheet of rain, almost like a car wash rinse, and then you see it. The sun. It is perfectly clear. The person you will be there will be stronger, with more understanding of how to run this race, and with satisfaction and peace. Yes, that person is tired, but they are also energized by the experience. I can't wait to use what God has taught me. I can't wait to learn more. I have explained it to my children like this. In every fairy tale, there is always a tragedy, and the protagonist faces that adversity, overcomes it, and thrives because of it. God is giving us our fairy tale. What do you see at the end?
I'm using stories this evening to, I guess, give a sense of what does it look like when Christians face adversity. That's our second story. We'll have another one in a minute. But what I'd like to do now is just spend a few moments just talking about some of the things we can be clear on in the Bible, even if sometimes they're difficult to reconcile. The first thing that we see in the Bible is a sense that God is all-powerful and he's all-loving. And I know that many of you will have been wrestling with that, even in the 5 minutes you spent with the Post-its. And it's a very difficult thing to try and bring together. But there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that the Bible gives us both of those things simultaneously. And probably that happens most clearly in the sense of the book of Job. And if you've spent any time in the book of Job, which is a long book, and bits of it are quite inaccessible. But the one thing you can't walk away from is the fact that God is completely in control. And he also loves Job in spite of the tragedy. And Job wants God to explain what's going on, and God doesn't. And if you read to the end, Job is content at the end of the story. He still believes that God is all-powerful. He understands that God loves him, but he's probably no nearer to reconciling those two things together. And various theologians have tried to get a sense of how do you understand those two things working. And none of them are desperately satisfactory, but the Bible tells us that they're true. And the closest that I can get, I suppose, as an ordinary Christian guy thinking about these things, is to imagine that situation. This is a trivial example, but that situation when my kids were 3 or 4, and they wanted something that they regarded as desperately important. And as a parent, I knew that it wasn't good for them. And so I denied them that opportunity. And they must have thought at the time I was unloving and I wasn't doing the right thing as a parent. But obviously I had knowledge that was way past their experience. And there seems to be a sense in the Bible that God is operating at a level which we can't understand. And we're creatures at the end of the day, and God is God. But that doesn't stop the fact that he's all powerful. And he's all loving. I think the other thing that comes across is in the whole of the Bible is that God is a suffering God. That God isn't just a distant God who is out there like the God of the dais, setting the universe off as a clockwork mechanism. But he's a God who puts on a human face and comes to this world to try and sort it out. I don't know if you've followed any of the Marvel superhero films over the last few years. These guys have got extraordinary gifts. Each one of them has got something special about them. And they bring that to bear on the problems of the world. And they just seem to create more problems. And the recent series is all about the aftermath of the problems they create by being superheroes. Jesus is not a superhero in spite of the children's song that we sometimes sing. What he did by suffering was to attack the problem of suffering in the world at its heart. And do something about it through his death and life and resurrection. So what does that look like? Well, we'll talk a little bit more about Jesus and his response to suffering in a moment. But I want to show you a clip of, from Rob Bell again. And this was something that Nick and Susanna put me onto. And it's a wonderful exploration, a very emotional exploration of suffering. It's about 8 minutes. Or was it 10 minutes? About 10 minutes. So you're going to get a longer clip this time, but it is very, very thought-provoking and I think very, very helpful.
Several years ago, when I was studying to become a pastor, I became friends with this family, and they had this son named Matthew, and this kid was so unusual. He it's hard to put into words. He had this old soul. You know what I mean? I mean, he was only a high school student. He was probably 15 or 16, but he was thinking about things and wrestling with issues so ahead of his time. And I remember I would have discussions with people who knew Matthew, and we'd say, like, what do you think that kid, what do you think he's going to do someday? What's he going to do with his life? And we would all say, whatever it is, it'll be extraordinary. I mean, this kid was so talented. And things became really tough for his family. And his parents split up. And so he came to live with me. So I'm this, seminary student in my early 20s, and I'm helping this high school kid get off to school in the morning. I was like this surrogate big brother. I, I will never forget those days. And then, he graduated and moved away to go to school and work, and then I got a job on the other side of the country, and so we would keep in touch. And he came to visit me one time, and I, when I was in town, I'd look him up, and we'd catch up and tell our stories. And then I got a call that Matthew had been in a terrible car accident, and that he was in the hospital in critical condition. And then a couple hours later, the same person called back, and they said, "Rob, he didn't make it." And it's like I keep replaying that moment. Like, "Rob, Matthew, he didn't make it." I have such vivid memories, like even where I was sitting, how the phone felt in my hand. It's like this numb feeling, this feeling that like everything's moving and yet it's standing perfectly still. And if there's anything I've learned or I'm learning, it's that whatever you're feeling in that moment, it's okay. It's okay. It's okay to feel numb. And for me, it's like anger, shock, denial. It's okay. Or just that feeling like you don't feel anything at all. And that's okay, too. And it's okay to have no answers and no explanations and maybe even no words. You know what does help? Is that Jesus wept. There's a story in the book of John. Jesus' friend Lazarus dies. And a couple days later, Jesus goes to Lazarus' village. And his family is there. And his friends. And they're all gathered around. And they're all just sobbing. They're all like, they're just mourning their loss. And Lazarus' sisters are even saying to Jesus, "You know, if you would have been here earlier, you know, maybe this wouldn't have happened." And Jesus enters into this just big giant mess, and he says, "Well, the scripture says that he's deeply moved in his spirit. Somewhere deep down, he just connects with this whole mess." And then the Bible reads these two words: Jesus wept. He feels all this pain and loss, and he enters into it, and he lets the full force of the moment hit him. It's because, like, you have to let it hit you. You can't avoid it. We can't, like, avoid our responses to things and think they'll go away. If we stuff it, then it's in there somewhere. And it will come out. We have to let it out, or it's in there somewhere. I mean, maybe you lost somebody a long time ago, and you never properly grieved. Then it's still in there somewhere. It's still in there. If the Son of God needs to let it out, if Jesus wept, then we do too. There's an ancient Jewish practice that taps into this in a profound way for me. Called sitting Shiva. And when you lose somebody that you love, or like if you know somebody who loses somebody that they love, then you go over to their house and you sit with them. You just sit. And you don't say anything. if at some point they want to talk, then you talk. If they prefer silence, then there's silence. I don't know if you've lost somebody close to you. I mean, maybe it was years and years ago, or maybe it was a couple of days ago. I mean, I don't know how long ago, or if it was just the other day. I am so sorry. I am so sorry for your loss. I do know that you and I have choices about the kinds of people we are and the kinds of people we're becoming. We have a choice whether or not we're going to become bitter. There's this woman in the Bible named Naomi, and she loses her husband and her two sons. And she says, don't call me Naomi anymore, call me Mara. And the word Mara is the Hebrew word for bitter. She's like, don't call me Naomi, call me bitter. A man named Job in the scriptures loses everything, children, houses, possessions, and his wife says, Job, are you still holding on to your integrity? Like, curse God and die. She becomes consumed with her bitterness. And if we don't acknowledge this choice, if we let a little bit of bitterness in, it'll take over. I mean, maybe you let that in a long time ago, or maybe you had that sense of guilt that comes with that. If only I would have done this, that wouldn't have happened. If only I would have been this way, if I would have done something differently. And so we can become racked with guilt, and it seeps in, and it becomes a part of us. We're not even aware of it. Don't let it happen. Don't let it happen. There's this ancient psalm where the writer says to God, it's like this prayer where he's just pouring out his pain. And he says, you've made me see trouble. You've made me see troubles, many and bitter. But you will restore me again. It's easy when we suffer loss. It's easy when we suffer loss for whatever it is that we lost to become the center of our life. We had them and now they're gone. And so there's like this giant hole where they once were, and it becomes all we can think about. And what happens in the process is our whole life becomes what we don't have, and we lose out on what we do have. Your heart, my heart, it will recover. It will recover. It will never, our hearts will never be the same again, but we will recover. The first Christians spoke about a day in the future when God would restore everything. You, me, everything in heaven and on earth. I find great hope in that. So may you realize that Jesus wept. And may you come to see that whatever you're feeling, it's okay. It's okay. And may you make the choice. May you make the choice not to become bitter and closed, but open. And may you realize that God is sitting Shiva with you, fully present, grieving your loss, but also restoring. And in that, may we find hope.
Some months ago, I was listening to some tapes of sermons by a New York pastor. And I think it was on the book of Jonah or something like that. It was a series from the Old Testament. And I think I got to the second or third sermon. And I realized that he wasn't talking about Jonah anymore. The particular sermon I was listening to, he seemed to be going in a completely different direction. And I didn't understand why he'd stopped the series until I looked at the date of the sermon. And the sermon was the 16th of the 9th, 2001. It was the first Sunday after 9/11. He wasn't going to talk about Jonah because he wanted to preach to his congregation and give them hope and encouragement after that terrible event. The words 9/11 weren't even mentioned in the service because at that time there was no 9/11 referred to. It was still this horrific event where they were still trying to find people. And so he was preaching to his congregation. And what do you preach on the Sunday after 9/11? And the pastor reached for the passage that Rob was talking about. The passage about Jesus and Lazarus. And it's a fascinating passage on a number of levels. Firstly, there's this delay, isn't there? Jesus is told about Lazarus and that he's in trouble and that he's ill. And he doesn't go straight away. And the sisters don't get that at all, do they? If you had been here, this wouldn't have happened. And that sense that Jesus' timing, like God's, was operating in a different way. And that sense that we resonate with, don't we? Those times we've said, God, we need you to turn up now. This is more important than anything else that's happened. We need you now to do something extraordinary because we're in trouble. And for whatever reason, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen for the sisters. Lazarus dies. Secondly, another crucial thing. Rob talks about the passage about Jesus being deeply moved in spirit and troubled. You need to get into the Greek at that point. Not that I'm a Greek scholar, but if you dig around, that phrase basically means that Jesus was incandescent with fury. It's dialed right down in most of the translations, because I think the translators didn't know what to do with the depth of that emotion. He is angry, like it's almost impossible to describe. Our God, when he sees the suffering of people, that's his emotional response. We don't understand why it happens, but emotionally, that's God's response in that situation. Jesus was so, so angry about the suffering of his friends. And then thirdly, Jesus wept. And have you ever read that story and wondered why Jesus wept? You see, Jesus knows the script. So he knows what's going to happen. He knows in about 10 minutes' time, there's going to be the most extraordinary miracle. I wonder what would you and I do at that point? I think I'd be quietly smug. I'd be thinking, yeah, I know, but I know what's happening next. I'd have that sense of, I've seen the script. I've seen the happy ending to this story. But Jesus, even in those few minutes, our God, come down in a human face, is unable to stop himself feeling the emotion of the people around him, the sense of tragedy that's happened with this man's life cut short. So the Bible doesn't always give us complete answers by any means to suffering, but it does paint a picture of what God is like. And in Jesus, we see a God whose timing is different to ours. But there's always a reason. And it might not be one we ever see in this life. It's a God who is angry about the state of the world. And again, we don't know why he doesn't just fix it. But his emotional response is there for all to see in that passage. And he's a God who weeps when his people are suffering. How should we face adversity? Well, I want to offer tentatively a few thoughts in terms of things that we might reflect on. And some of those have come out of the stories that we've heard. Rob's story about Matthew, the story of Emily, the story of the Christians. First one is that when Christians face suffering, then maybe a starting point is just keep walking. We're not like the Stoics who stand like a rock, letting the suffering wash over us. Maybe we just need to take a step at a time if we possibly can. Like the woman who was struggling with divorce and her husband who's left her, taking a step at a time. God has told us that he won't forsake us. Even if we're feeling alone, we have that promise. Secondly, weeping. A number of people have talked to me, and this was echoed with Dave's comment in the small group, about the importance of lament. And it's probably not something we as a culture do very well. But that sense that it's okay to emotionally respond to this suffering, to weep, to ask questions, to be blunt with God. Thirdly, trusting, which is incredibly difficult in those circumstances. But I want to just talk to you about briefly about the story of Joseph. We all know the story of Joseph. But can you imagine before he gets finally elevated, before he finally saves Egypt and the whole of the Western world at that time, imagine he's the day before he gets hauled up in front of Pharaoh and asked to interpret his dream. His life has been an absolute car crash, hasn't it? What must he have felt up to that point? Because we get no sense that Joseph had a sense of destiny, that he was going to save the world through his governorship of Egypt. He was just a guy who was going through this train wreck of a tragedy. And no matter what he seemed to do the right thing, he still ends up in jail and in misery. And yet you play the tape to the end, and even Joseph recognizes that his brothers meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. And I think Joseph's helpful because it just gives us a glimpse sometimes of the fact that God has got a purpose. But a lot of us won't see that purpose this side of eternity. Hoping is sometimes difficult to see that plan, isn't it? That sense that God is doing something extraordinary with our lives. But the Bible suggests that all things work for good for those who trust him. And that might be incredibly difficult to face in certain circumstances. But that sense of hope that maybe God has got something planned that we don't fully understand. And some of it we'll see in this life, and some of it will be in the next. The early church believed this, and that's why they felt they could take extraordinary risks. Because they had a sense that God had a purpose in this life, that he was renewing this world, but also that there was a life afterwards, where you would be reunited with those people that you loved. And I want to finish on that, and I want to give the last words of this evening to C.S. Lewis. How many people have read The Last Battle? It's an extraordinary children's story, isn't it? And if you've not read it for a while or you haven't read it, at the end of the last book, the children are with Aslan, the lion, who is unashamedly a Christ-like figure. And they're worried that the story that they're involved with is coming to an end, and they're going to have to go back to boring mundane England. And this is how Lewis finishes the last book. Lucy said, "We're so afraid of being sent away, Aslan, and you have sent us back into our own world so often." "No fear of that," said Aslan. "Have you not guessed?" Their hopes leaped, and a wild hope rose within them. "There was a real railway accident," said Aslan softly. "Your father and mother and all of you are, as you used to call it, in the Shadowlands, dead. The term is over. The holidays have begun. The dream is ended. This is the morning." And as he spoke, he no longer looked to them like a lion. But the things that began to happen after that were so great and beautiful that I cannot write them. And for us, this is the end of all the stories. And we can most truly say that they all lived happily ever after. But for them, it was only the beginning of the real story. All of their life in this world and all their adventures in Narnia had only been the cover and the title page. Now, at last, they were beginning chapter one of the great story which no one on earth has ever read, which goes on forever, in which every chapter is better than the one before.